Welcome to Depression and Anxiety Recovery. I'm quite excited to introduce you to Session 6. For those who know me well, what you will learn today is one of my most favorite topics, the frontal lobe, or the very front part of the brain, which is to be the crown or control center of the entire brain and body. So enhancing frontal lobe functions is also very much involved in overcoming harmful habits or addictions. So let's get into the lobes of the brain, since we're speaking about the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is the area of analysis. This is also our decision-making portion of the brain. We call it the willpower, and it's also the spiritual part of the brain. The parietal lobe is where mathematics is at, calculation, division, subtraction. It's also where language comprehension is at, and a lot of our vocabulary has to do with the frontal, with the parietal lobe. When we're learning new languages, the parietal lobe is being stimulated. Then we have the temporal lobe. This is where music enters in, but it's also the area of memory. And so if we're having significant memory issues, often it's due to the temporal lobe of the brain. Then in the back portion of the brain, we have the occipital lobe. This is where vision is centered and visual spatial orientation is involved here. And then our coordination center is the cerebellum. This is where we can do things with grace and athleticism, is this important area of the brain. Now, every mammal has a brain, and of course, other creatures can have a brain too, but every mammal also has a frontal lobe. And cats, although their brain is quite small, only 3.5% of a cat's brain is in the frontal lobe. What does this mean? Not much morality in a cat. The frontal lobe is also the moral control center. And I was raised with dogs. Dogs have a little more frontal lobe. 7% of their brain is in their frontal lobe. And as a result, they're able to empathize with others. They also have a little more of the moral aspect of things. For instance, being raised with dogs, I was shocked when I went over my young friend's house a few doors down. And he had a cat, and I was shocked to see this cat torturing a mouse to death in his garage and enjoying the process. And a dog would not enjoy that process. It would want to put it out of its misery. But the cat would take a bite out of it, watch it run, and then grab it again. And I didn't realize that anyone who enjoys torture is a sign of serious frontal lobe compromise. And this is just due to their limited frontal lobe ability and not really being able to empathize with others. Also, if you've noticed, when you're home, cats are glad that you're being fed, but they don't necessarily care too much whether you're home or not, where the dog has a relationship with you. Happy when you come home and wants to tell you about that and also welcome you gladly. That's due to that enhanced frontal lobe that dogs have. Chimpanzees have the most of any other animal species. 17% of their brain is in the frontal lobe. But what sets us apart from the rest of the animal kingdom is our frontal lobe size. Notice that huge jump from chimpanzees, 33% up to 38% of the human brain is in the frontal lobe. And this is what gives us the ability to accomplish advanced planning and thinking. It also gives us the ability to reflect upon ourselves. And when we're speaking of mental health, there, out of all the mammals, there's only one that actually commits suicide or even considers suicide, and that is the human. No other animal, no matter how bad their life is, would ever consider doing that because their frontal lobe isn't large enough to be able to reflect upon themselves. But just the fact that someone might think that they would be better off dead is a sign that they have frontal lobe function. They may not be using it well. They may be having a lot of distorted thinking. It's not working great. But the ability to reflect upon oneself is a frontal lobe phenomenon. Now, when the frontal lobe begins to be compromised, not only can we maybe think pretty morbid thoughts like this, but there's other things that can happen. Moral principle will go down. If we want to follow the decline of morality in an individual or in a group of people, it's going to the answer is going to be right there in the frontal lobe of the brain. Our ability to reason from cause to effect is a frontal lobe phenomenon. And that means to have appropriate foresight, to be able to notice that if these things all come together, then this is eventually going to happen. That's the frontal lobe that does that. And we can actually follow our child's frontal lobe development by how far they're looking into the future. You know, if you have a young child and you tell him on Wednesday that something's going to happen this weekend, he might be excited on Wednesday to hear about it, but he's too young, and by the time the weekend comes about, you'll have to remind him because he's not able to see that far ahead. The frontal lobe is not very well developed in childhood. But after in their second grade, they'll know next year I'm going to be in the third grade. They'll be able to look that far ahead. And hopefully their brains develop where they can plan wisely for their career and their marriage partner. It actually takes 30 years for the frontal lobe to be structurally and anatomically completely developed in human beings. And this is something that a lot of people don't understand. They think if they've reached their adult size and weight, their brain is as good as a 30 or 35-year-old when they're 18 or when they're 16. That is not true. They might reach their adult size and weight, but the frontal lobe is not through developing. And of course, that gives us a lot of compassion and hope for the younger age groups that don't seem to be using or having as good a frontal lobe function. Abstract reasoning is impaired when the frontal lobe goes down. That means our ability to interpret proverbs and even understand higher forms of math, such as higher algebra and calculus, which require a frontal lobe to comprehend. Loss of empathy. We've mentioned that in the animal world, but this is also true in the human world. You might have heard the phrase, "There's no way that you can understand what she's gone through until you have walked in her shoes." That's actually not a true statement if the person has a well-developed frontal lobe. Studies show you can just hear about what happened to her and you will feel precisely those same emotions when you have a good frontal lobe. If you don't have a good frontal lobe, that is true. You're not going to understand at all unless the same thing happened to you. Lack of restraint occurs when the frontal lobe goes down. That means we have boasting, we have hostility, we can have loss of temper much more readily when the frontal lobe goes down. And our emotional control in general is down. Managing our emotions requires a good frontal lobe. So there has been well documented now in the scientific literature in many different ways a relationship between depression, anxiety, and frontal lobe function. What we find is that when the circulation and activity of the frontal lobe goes down, and we can see this in SPECT scans, then we're going to end up with depression, anxiety, or other conditions. But particularly, depression is even more related than anxiety of having a suppressed frontal lobe. And Dr. Drevets presented compelling evidence that frontal lobe compromise happens first and then the depression. And if we want to get better from depression, we have to enhance the frontal lobe first. And then that's how we can get this transformative, wonderful change where depression and even anxiety can be eradicated. So one of the main characteristics of virtually all depressed individuals and anxious individuals, no matter what the underlying cause, is a significant decrease in the frontal lobe's blood flow and activity. And so we see this across the board. No matter what the form of depression is, even bipolar depression is even more involved in frontal lobe suppression. People with bipolar disorder, even in their mania phase, the frontal lobe is like disconnected from the rest of their brain, and they're just working on that other aspect and not the frontal lobe of their brain. So how can we compromise our frontal lobe? Well, there's a number of different ways in which we can have what's called frontal lobe hits or blows to the brain. Recreational drugs is one of those methods. And whether the drug is alcohol or another recreational drug that people are seeking after, you can be assured that frontal lobe compromise is part of the effects of that drug. We're going to talk more about that. Certain prescription drugs, such as benzos, will also suppress the frontal lobe. Now, these drugs can make us feel calmer at first, but they have a compromise right away, actually, when we're taking our Xanax or Valium or lorazepam, and it's actually suppressing this important area of the frontal lobe. This is why personality changes can even occur in people on chronic benzos, and they can have relationship issues, et cetera, because they're not able to empathize as much. Now, fortunately, our program has been shown to be helpful in people getting off of benzos. So if you want to consider getting off of benzos, this is a good time. You would want, of course, to see your doctor to do it wisely. We don't want you to do this on your own. But once that benzo is no longer on board, the frontal lobe will have a chance of really getting more powerfully involved in a positive way in your life. Certain medical conditions, such as high blood pressure and high cholesterol over time, can compromise the frontal lobe. And then certain forms of entertainment. Entertainment television, which is known by the rapid scene of reference changes every 3 to 5 seconds, the frontal lobe can't keep up with that. So when the movie is occurring and you see someone going up to a door and grabbing the door handle, then you see someone behind the door 2 seconds later, then you see another angle of someone opening the door, and you see all this camera switching going on, the frontal lobe says, I can't keep up with all of those scenes, and so it just goes dormant. The parietal lobe is still working, but we're no longer critically analyzing the input that's coming in, and it has some significant adverse effects. Gaming also, video gaming, suppresses the frontal lobe. MTV viewing is a type of entertainment television that's been shown to be powerfully suppressant on the frontal lobe. With the combination of music and sensual images and these fast-moving images, it will also suppress the frontal lobe. Distractibility aspects of smartphones and media. And this is something that I didn't first understand when smartphones came available. I thought this would be a little better than entertainment television, because we don't have any control of the scene of reference when we're watching a movie or entertainment television. But we do have control of the scene of reference on a smartphone. You know, we can press it and go to some other place, and so we have more managed control over it. And so I was thinking, well, this will be superior because it's involving more of our input and we're having to make choices on that device. But what I didn't realize was the distractibility element. Notice there on the screen, it says distractibility aspect of smartphones and media. If we use the smartphone in quotes the normal way, we are going to be powerfully distracted. In other words, we'll get on our phone to do something useful, but before we even do something useful, we're going to be distracted because a Snapchat came in or a news notification came in. Or wait a minute, I got this email. And as you're actually answering the email, you now get some other notification. And so this division of attention, where we're not paying attention for more than 90 seconds or 3 minutes, begins to suppress the frontal lobe of the brain. It's called the anterior cingulate gyrus of the frontal lobe. And this is the area that we need for focused attention. And when our brains don't need to have focused attention anymore, it starts to prune that area down. So we can actually see a shrinkage of the anterior cingulate gyrus. The bad news about that shrinkage is that's the gyrus we need to manage distressing emotions. So if we're not going to be able to focus, we're not going to be able to manage our emotions. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen a skyrocketing of mental illness lately since the release of these devices. Now, we can still utilize these devices in ways that are not distracting, but you have to be very intentional to do that well. Another frontal lobe hit are other addictions that may not be substance addictions. Sexual addictions have been shown to be powerfully suppressing the frontal lobe. And if we're not regular contemplating spiritual themes or abstract thinking, our frontal lobe is not being stimulated, and it will also start to go down. So this is why a devotional life and thinking of more grand and abstract themes in a practical way can be very helpful for the frontal lobe. Another way that a lot of people are experiencing is habitually going against your conscience. When you go against your conscience, the area that convicts you is your frontal lobe. Wait a minute, I went against my own values. And when we do that repeatedly, our frontal lobe starts to shrink and go down so that we don't feel as guilty. And this is how people's value systems can even change. They might have had a good set of value systems and it's really been corrupted as a result of continually going against their conscience. But the consequence of this is the frontal lobe circulation and activity goes down with all of the resulting problems that can result. So the first thing we want to talk about is the importance of eliminating frontal lobe hits. And addictions are at an all-time high in our society. And as you have figured out, these addictions all have a signature, whether it's substance or non-substance, in suppressing the frontal lobe. By changing your relationship with frontal lobe suppressing behaviors, you can combat depression, anxiety, and enhance your frontal lobe, which will greatly enhance your life fulfillment and your happiness. So we ought to define, what is an addiction? Addictions all have characteristics effect of suppressing the activity of the frontal lobe. And the goal is to eliminate anything that will suppress the frontal lobe of the brain so it can begin to achieve its full potential. So there are two aspects, no longer suppressing the frontal lobe and then participating in activities that are going to enhance the frontal lobe. But the first thing we really need to do is to get rid of the suppressant ones, which means getting rid of the addiction. The American Addiction Society talks about five common characteristics of addictions: overwhelming compulsion to continually use, need for increased amounts, dependency, meaning that if we get away from it, we're going to have some withdrawal symptoms, high tendency to relapse, we might actually get away from it for a couple of weeks, or maybe a couple of months, and then stress comes back in and we find that we're using it again. Detrimental effect on the individual or society. Now, the American Addiction Association states we don't need all five of those, although they are present in many addictions, but we need three of five to qualify as having an addiction. So that can help us with the definitions. So addictions, at first, seem to cause a euphoria. Most people that first try an addictive substance actually think, you know, I was told this was bad, but I think it's very good for me in the way it's altering the way I feel. I feel actually a little bit euphoric, or maybe a lot euphoric. So I want to go into something that all of us, I think, have participated in. And if you haven't participated on this, you might choose something else that pretty much everybody has done. But the one that I think many people can identify with is the potential addiction of chocolate. Now, I should mention at the outset, not everyone is addicted to chocolate. And there are different gender associations. For instance, 40% of females do have an addictive relationship to chocolate. In other words, when you compare those five, they're going to be there. They're going to have three out of those five. About 10% of males. Some addictions are much more common in males than they are in females. But let's say you don't even remember when your first chocolate was. It might have been 3 years old at grandma's house for Christmas. And grandma has that Hershey bar and wants to please her grandson or granddaughter. And you ask for it and you start eating that Hershey bar. What's going to happen to your dopamine activity in your brain? This is actually going to stimulate. Is it going to go up just a little bit or is it going to go up a lot? It's actually going to surge, and it's going to look like this. So at the very top of the screen here is euphoria. So it's almost up there in that euphoric range. And you're saying, wow, this tastes so good. And I think I even feel better eating this chocolate. Now, after you do that, does it stay up there for a long time or does it come down really quickly? It actually comes down quite quickly. And addictions at first seem to cause euphoria, but they immediately begin to alter brain chemistry. How does it alter brain chemistry? It actually no longer comes down to neutral. It comes down a little bit below neutral, almost imperceptible how much it's gone down below neutral. But now your dopamine, what we call set point, or your average, is down there below neutral. So the dopamine activity begins to decline. But of course, you know where that Hershey bar is, and you ask grandma, that was so good. Is there more? And grandma says, oh yeah, you can have some more. And so the Hershey bar is given again, and this time it surges again. But does it go up as high as it was the first time? Not quite. So you notice there's a little bit of difference there. And it quickly goes back down again. But once again, the set point has lowered even a little more. And of course, you find out where those Hershey bars are at, and grandma seems to be so agreeable that you don't even ask her this time. You just go over there and get it. And the dopamine surges, and then it comes back down quickly again. And you are averaging a low dopamine set point. So the repetition of the addictive behavior causes more and more dopamine receptors to be lost and less dopamine to be produced and released. And this brings about a new neutral dopamine activity that's far below neutral. Well, let's say you just can't seem to stop and you keep going back to this chocolate. And now, maybe several weeks, several months later, you have done this 1,000 times. Where is your dopamine set point now? It's actually down almost in the dysphoric range. Now, we should mention, nothing bad is going on in your life at that point. It's not like terrible things have happened, but you almost feel like terrible things have happened. And now when you eat the chocolate, it's just going up to neutral. So this is very characteristic of addictions. First, you do it to try to get high and to have that euphoria. But after the course of time, you're actually doing it to feel numb, to feel neutral. And this is why many people with addictions have this mindset. Their mindset is, this is bad for most people, but for me, I need it. You don't recognize that the way I'm made up, I actually need this because without this, I'm going to have this deep, distressing sense of deprivation all the time. And so I need to have this in order to feel neutral, even just for a few minutes. What they don't realize is that if they gave up their addiction and began to stimulate their frontal lobe in very positive ways, this dopamine pathway would change. Now, I'm going to give you an example. In my own life, growing up, that really has it stuck out, and of course it's something that I remember to this day. But when I was a young teenager, my father was addicted to chocolate. But not just chocolate. He was addicted to anything with a sweet taste. Reese's peanut butter cups, chocolate-covered cherries, ice cream, root beer floats, sodas, Toll House cookies, you name it, whatever was sugary and sweet and good, he loved. He began to get overweight. He began to get more irritable. And bad things started happening in his workplace. Two of his friends, who were in their 40s, and he was in his 40s at the time, died suddenly of heart attacks. And he knew his mom and dad had died of strokes and heart attacks in their 50s. He's in his 40s, and he's thinking, you know what, I could be next. He was an engineer. He wasn't a medical person. But someone gave him a book called Sugar Blues. And he started reading that book, and he realized, I've got all of the characteristics of a sugarholic, and I'm suffering all of these consequences. And as he read through that book, he made the decision, I'm going to give up sugar. He came home to my mom. I remember that night when he came home and he said, I am done with sugar. She smiled big because she thought, yeah, that's what he's saying, but he's addicted. There's no way he's going to be able to give this up. And she even forgot about it the next night because he came home and guess what she was making? Chocolate chip Toll House cookies. And the smell was overwhelming. He said, I can't take this. So he went out of the house and he worked in the garden so he didn't have to be around that smell all the time. And he had no sugar for 24 hours on day one. Day two, no sugar. Day three, no sugar. Now it's a couple of weeks, and my mom is starting to feel sorry for him. She's making these blueberry pies for us with this sugar, and she decided, I'll make him one too, but with no sugar. And he started enjoying these blueberry pies without sugar. He was always very grateful. Oh, honey, it's so nice for you to do this just for me. You don't need to do this for me. But he was happy to have those blueberry pies without sugar. But something happened 4 months into it. No sugar and no artificial sweeteners now to keep that sweet taste up for 4 months, 16 weeks into it. The pies are reversed, and he bites into a pie that she says has no sugar, but it has sugar in it. He eats that, takes a couple of bites, and he can't eat any more of it. He says, this is a sickening sweet. I can't enjoy this at all. I can't believe I used to like this stuff. This is not tasting good at all to me. And she says, you're nuts. That was the pie without sugar. I don't know what's happened to your taste buds, but that's the pie without sugar. And she dips into her pie, which she thinks has the sugar, and her mouth puckers up, and she says, you are right. This is terrible. I can't understand how in the world you can eat these blueberry pies without sugar. Well, what began to happen at that point is when he started to eat natural food, like an apple or corn on the cob, his dopamine levels were not surging, but they gradually came up into a nice, healthy range. And he couldn't help but comment on it. This corn is like dessert. It's great. And then after he finished eating, instead of that going back down again, that dopamine level would stay up for hours thereafter. He began to exercise at that time, and just going on a mile and a half walk in the neighborhood would bring it about even more smiles in regards to how beautiful it is to be able to walk and get this fresh air. And he was no longer with dopamine levels below neutral like he had done before. So both groups get their dopamine. The difference is when you're not on any addictions, you actually have dopamine levels far above neutral the vast majority of the day. And this is the beautiful thing about giving up things that produce these dopamine surges. So the addictions and going to these either substances or non-substances that produce this big dopamine activity, it's actually a false way of altering the way you feel. And you can never get enough of what you don't need, because what you don't need will never satisfy you. My father found out he did not need those Reese's peanut butter cups. He found out he didn't even need ice cream or root beer floats. In just 16 weeks, he enjoyed simple food more than he had ever remembered in his life and was feeling so much better. His weight was now down. His ideal weight was very close to being obtained. And why is it that what you don't need will never satisfy you? It won't satisfy you because it will lower those dopamine set points considerably. So what other addiction hits can produce these surges? Alcohol can do it. Even nicotine, although it's maybe not as much of a surge, nicotine can also produce that big dopamine surge and is, of course, is highly addictive. Marijuana also is highly addictive. Opioids, benzos, illicit drugs such as meth and cocaine. Other addictions that can lead to depression and anxiety are things like caffeine. We talked about technology, smartphones. Social media has a very addictive aspect to it, with those likes and those different aspects of finding out what others are doing can be highly addictive and produce lower dopamine set points. Syncopated rhythm music can do this. Gambling also can do it. And technology, smartphones, and YouTube can do it, as well as self-mutilation can also be addictive and be a false way of altering the way you feel and produce surges in brain chemistry. The most common substance addiction in the world is actually a caffeine addiction. And caffeine actually does suppress the frontal lobe of the brain. It blocks the adenosine receptors in the frontal lobe, and studies show you are more likely to gossip with caffeine on board. What is gossip? It's sharing private information with someone who's not part of the problem or part of the solution to the problem. So it means you're not being deceptive, you're not being slanderous, but you can start betraying your friends without even realizing it. Then later, your friend is asking, why did you tell her that story? I heard what you told about me. For what purpose were you saying that? And you're saying, I don't know why I told them that. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And relationships get affected as a result of gossip. In fact, one big article was written on caffeine calling it the silent killer of emotional intelligence. And it does reduce blood flow to the brain by 27% on average, some people over 40% reduction in blood flow. Marijuana also has a significant adverse effect on the brain. Cannabis use has been shown to impair numerous cognitive functions, from basic motor coordination to more complex executive function tasks, including your ability to plan, organize, solve problems, make decisions, remember, and control emotions and behavior. Prestigious scientific bodies like the National Academy of Sciences have reported on this, with it lowering IQ, cognitive deficits. If you've had it more recently, it affects it more. But also if you've used it at an earlier onset and how long you've used it, all of those have a role to play in lowering our IQ. Among short-term and long-term marijuana users, those who have chronic heavy cannabis use show the most enduring results. And if you've been using it for a long time, your IQ, even after you give it up, will not be as high as it would have been had you never used the marijuana. And so that's why it's best to get off of this earlier rather than later. But it's still better to get off of it later than not at all. Cannabis appears to exert impairing effects on executive functions even after 3 weeks or more of abstinence. Basic attentional and working memory abilities are largely restored long term when you get off it, but enduring and noticeable deficits are found in decision making, concept formation, and planning. So there appears to be cognitive problems for persistent cannabis usage. And one of those things that also occurs is getting to the point of nihilism when we're using marijuana regularly. So that breaches over into the area of psychosis. If you look up marijuana-induced psychosis, you will find that marijuana significantly increases the risk of psychosis. And that's different than alcohol. Alcohol does suppress the frontal lobe. It can cause all sorts of relationship issues. It can cause problems when you're inebriated. But it doesn't breach over into the area of psychosis, where marijuana gets into the psychosis part. So the paranoia, even mania, marijuana-induced mania. And with this nihilism, you kind of think that everyone would be better off dead. And so the one thing that's virtually on board of every mass shooter is marijuana, not alcohol per se. There might be alcohol there too, but it's marijuana because of that nihilistic psychosis aspects of things. So marijuana and weapons do not go well together. Adolescence, even more dangerous. 8-point IQ decline from childhood to adulthood if you're using marijuana as a teenager. It does have a neurotoxic effect on the adolescent brain, but it's also not good for adults as well. Alvin Toffler, a media expert, showed us why there are more fun things to do than ever before in human history, but why we have more depression than ever before in human history. And you would think that with TV and devices and video games in abundance, we would have the lowest rates of depression ever in world history. But such is not the case. So why is that? Alvin Toffler says constant stimulation of the senses shuts down the analytical processes and ultimately shuts down the ability to face life rationally. This leads to escape techniques that involve withdrawal, apathy, and rejection of disciplined thinking when faced with difficult duties and decisions. So many of these devices are constantly stimulating ourselves, and that constant stimulation shuts down the frontal lobe, the analytical processes. And notice, we're going to reject disciplined thinking when faced with difficult duties and decisions. That's when we need our disciplined thinking the most, is when we have difficult duties and decisions. But when we are constantly stimulating ourselves with this gaming and entertainment world, we will reject that. And this is why such poor decision making is being done in so many people with this background. One of the things that entertainment can do is also hypnotize us. Hypnosis attempts to cancel out frontal lobe function and bring people into a trance in which they are highly suggestible. This course is trying to teach you to manage your own emotions and manage yourself by enhancing your frontal lobe. But one of the characteristics of hypnosis, as you see, is to cancel out frontal lobe functions. It's most easily accomplished by training your eyes to focus in on one object, the best object being a little flickering light. Now, there's many ways in which people can be hypnotized, but the flickering light, every few seconds, the irregular flicker as you're focusing totally on that, can start to suppress the frontal lobe of the brain. And what is it that you might have in your house that trains you to focus in on one object and flickers? It is your entertainment television set. There have been over 300 books written on the subjects of the effects of entertainment television in the mind, over 3,000 studies written on those effects. And those studies show 17 different ways the frontal lobe is suppressed as a result of entertainment television. In fact, one more daily hour of TV as a teenager will double your risk of academic failure. Not just increase it by 10%, double your risk of academic failure because of that suppression of the frontal lobe. The hypnotized person records information and duties, but no longer in the appropriate subset without interpretation or frontal lobe activity. Our thoughts and feelings are highly influenceable, and our thoughts can be skewed by external forces we're not even aware of. One of those external forces we've already mentioned, and the media device that is a super stimulus that has all these great possible functions in this tiny aspect, is the smartphone. And the reason why our thoughts and feelings are influenceable is because our brain is a monitoring system as well as a thinking system. So its attention is drawn toward any object that is new, intriguing, or otherwise striking. And these objects can interrupt our life at a time when we're focusing, at just about any time, because we have them with us so much. Media and communication devices, from telephones to TV sets, have always tapped in to this curiosity. And now, the most common non-substance addiction in the world is technology addiction. It's even surpassed gambling and sexual addictions. Technology might be just as addictive as alcohol and drugs, could also wreak havoc on personal and work relationships. And psychologists specializing in addiction have classified technology addiction as an impulse disorder that can be as socially damaging as alcoholism, gambling, and drug addiction. Warning signs include using text messages or email when face-to-face interaction would be more appropriate, limiting time with friends and family to tend to your emails or surf the internet. If you're limiting social face-to-face interaction in order to do this, it's a big giant warning sign. Foregoing meaningful activities or time outdoors because of technology usage, and not keeping up with work, school, or home assignments because of screen time. Out of all media devices, although all of these can do it, the smartphone stands out. Its information and entertainment-packed smartphone acts as a type of supernormal stimulus, and that means it can hijack attention whenever it's part of our surroundings. While phones offer convenience and diversion, they have also been shown to breed anxiety, and their extraordinary usefulness gives them an unprecedented hold on attention and a vast influence over our thinking and behavior. In a recent Gallup survey, more than half of smartphone owners said they could not even imagine life without this device anymore. 40% of users said they feel anxious if their phone was lost for a day. 50% of our people under 18 admit that they are addicted to their phones. More than them are addicted, but half of people under the age of 18 admit that they're addicted to it. Using a smartphone or even hearing one ring or vibrate produces distractions that make it harder to concentrate on a difficult problem or job. And as one researcher said, our attachment to our phones has grown so intense that their mere presence diminishes intelligence. So this was an interesting study done in the state of California that I'm in now. 520 undergraduate students were given two standard tests of intellectual acuity, IQ type of test, a measure of how fully a person's mind can focus on a particular task. And the second assessed more of that IQ part, a person's ability to interpret and solve an unfamiliar problem. The only variable in the experiment was the location of the subject's smartphones. Some placed their phones in front of them on their desks, others put their phones in their pockets or handbags, and still others left their phones in a different room altogether. The results were absolutely striking. In both tests, the subjects whose phones were in view posted the worst scores, while those who left their phones in a different room did the best. Students who kept their phones in their pockets or bags came out in the middle, and the researcher said, as phone proximity increased, brain power did what? Decreased. But yet, all the participants said their phones weren't a distraction. They hadn't even thought about the devices during the experiment. So they were totally oblivious to the effect that this phone was having because the data clearly showed it had a very important effect. Cognitive risk from daily smartphone usage caused this. It diminishes vital mental skills such as learning, creativity, abstract thought, logical reasoning, and problem solving. Imagine that a drug was released that you could take to try to help yourself in some way, shape, or form, but it did all those bad things. And imagine if the drug company never looked for those bad things, and then it was discovered that they knew about those bad things afterwards. We would say these are greedy, bad, unethical people, but yet the studies are very clear that these technology devices do all of those adverse things. And people shrug their shoulders as if, oh, well, this is very serious stuff, particularly when it's increased mental illness so much. Major longitudinal study looked at the lives of more than 1 million young people. Teens who spent large amounts of time glued to their phone and computer screens are markedly less happy than those who prefer real-world activities and interactions. Whether it was social media, texting, video chatting, multi-platform video games, all associated with a decrease in happiness. Who were the happiest youth? Those who were doing real-world activities, playing sports, reading newspapers, engaging in face-to-face social interaction, significantly happier. And then we see that statistic. It's happened in every country since the United States. When over 50% of people own a smartphone, rates of depression and anxiety go up considerably. Also rates of suicide. And it's happened now in Kenya and these other third world countries as a result of the normal use of smartphones and the pervasive use that's come into most countries of the world utilizing this. The happiest teenagers are those who use digital media less than 1 hour a day. After a daily hour of screen time, levels of unhappiness rise steadily. Social media is also shown to make us antisocial. We're attached to social media as a means of connection, but soon virtually everyone ends up comparing far more than they connect. And comparing ourselves among ourselves is not wise. We compare via a false world as well. We don't recognize that this social media has people presenting themselves as you want, as they want to be seen, and not actually how they are as well. And I could give you some significant examples of that. Media devices waste a lot of time, sometimes hours each day. They keep us from doing healthy activities, spending time with our families, engaging in productive work. And children may learn more from devices from their parents and tend to trust their devices over their parents. In fact, the research today shows that the average kid has learned more from their device than they have their parent. And what they're learning from their device is not always very accurate. In fact, it's leading them to distorted ways of thinking. And when parents use devices, children tend to use them even more. So being at home using devices are not the best way to raise our children. So we should have access every day to no screens and no distractions. We call that a digital Sabbath. Dr. Daniel Goleman says this is a key of success. Digital Sabbath is a time when adults and kids are not being distracted by devices, and during that time engage in focused learning or healthy activities. So I would like to encourage you to partake in what Victoria Dunkley, a child and adolescent psychiatrist in Los Angeles, calls an e-fast. An electronic fast is where you're not using any screens or electronic devices for a total of 6 weeks. She says she's asked to diagnose so many kids with mental health disorders, but after the e-fast, she finds out most of those kids don't have any mental health disorder. It was actually induced as a result of the electronic world that they were living in. After the 6 week e-fast, you will more than likely normalize if you have a mental condition and you're an adolescent. So we recommend once you get the screen back, because it's just 6 weeks and it's really hard to live your life completely without some of the helpful effects of these devices, we recommend you turn off all push notifications, all email notifications, all news notifications, any ability to have Snapchat or things distract you throughout the day, and be committed to spend less than an hour a day on a device outside of work and also be committed to not use any devices an hour before your bedtime. Lay them aside, and that will help you with your circadian rhythm. I would also recommend that you look at your apps. If you get stuck in any app that wastes time, get rid of that app. It's not worth it. Even if it's a helpful app, get rid of it. Now, you won't have to get rid of all of your apps. I don't see people getting stuck on their calculator, trying what 32 plus 54 is, or multiplication or division. They're not stuck there. I also don't see people getting stuck on their GPS app. They'll use it when they need to, but otherwise they're not getting stuck and wasting time there. But they will get stuck on YouTube. They'll get stuck on social media. They'll get stuck on a lot of different apps. It's not worth it. Just eliminate those apps, and you will be far better off spending your time. Another aspect that tends to come with devices, but can come even without devices, is a study on pornography. You know, at the time when pornography was out there, or I should say before even the internet came about with pornography, two researchers came together, one from University of Wisconsin, one from University of Indiana, to find out if Hugh Hefner and his followers were right that pornography was just creative art, displaying beauty, and had no real harms associated with it. And so in order to do this, they did a prospective trial on 300 university students that had never been previously exposed to pornography. The researchers in universities today say we can't do that study anymore because there's been so much wide exposure since the internet came about. But as mentioned, this was just before the internet came out. And so 300 men and women were involved in this study, randomized to either regular magazines, regular movies, or pornographic magazines or pornographic movies. And we saw a huge difference emerge within 6 weeks. If you were randomized to the pornography section, less interested or less attracted to your partner, if you had one, became more self-absorbed, less empathetic towards others. In other words, that frontal lobe was suppressing in empathy, began to live in a very self-centered world. Anxiety went up and willpower went down. So self-control way down, and began to emotionally shut down in a period of just 6 weeks. Dr. Zillman, one of the authors, said the negative effects of pornography have been more consistently proven now than the links between smoking and lung cancer. So this is a dangerous aspect in regards to your brain, and it's very important. That's also highly addictive. It's very important that if you are having this type of exposure, you go through that clean break and make that commitment, and your dopamine levels will also start to improve. So overcoming any addiction requires the understanding of temperance. Temperance is moderation in the use of healthy substances, but complete abstinence from unhealthy substances. And this is what we're asking you to commit to, is become a temperate person. Now, you might ask, why abstinence from the unhealthy? Well, first, because it is unhealthy, and we shouldn't be playing with unhealthy things. But secondly, is because of the addictive frontal lobe suppressing aspects of unhealthy behaviors, where it can start to hook us. And to be moderate in things that suppress the frontal lobe of the brain is virtually an impossibility. Some people will fool themselves into thinking they're moderate, but if something changes in their life where they have more stress, or even if they win the lottery, they're going to have that full aspect of getting totally hooked. And so we don't want to have that hook be possible. A person who has a compulsive relationship with something can no more use it moderately than an alcoholic can return to moderate drinking, or a nicotine addict can return to moderate smoking. So in dealing with any addictive habit, total abstinence for life is necessary. The good news is we have the ability to choose our own pleasures. And if we reward ourselves with a bad habit periodically, we undermine our ability to develop enjoyment of a lifestyle that is free of that agent. And that's simply because our dopamine set points cannot climb back up to neutral. So we feel this deep, distressing sense of deprivation, even if we're only utilizing it once a month or so. You might think, well, once a month is still better than more often, and that's true, but the desire is still being kept alive and giving rise to that deep, distressing sense of deprivation. But if the addiction is permanently abandoned, like my father did, and the thoughts directed toward the joy of being free of that sugar addiction, the addiction will soon not be missed. My uncle used to love coming up to Michigan, where I was raised. He was a General Motors engineer, so that's why we lived in Michigan. And he said it was worth the trip just to see my dad eat natural food. He enjoyed it so much. He hadn't seen something like this. And not only would it help my father's dopamine levels, it was helping everyone's dopamine levels around him in regards to the great change that took place in his brain. You first must have the knowledge that the habit is destructive, and then you need to choose to overcome. Be persistent. It'll be well worth the effort. Get rid of anything that is producing a dopamine surge in your life, and it'll be well worth the effort. Now, a surge is different than just getting healthy dopamine. Remember, that surge is when it shoots way up, which is the characteristics of these addictions. But going for a walk and eating healthy food can produce nice dopamine levels too, but it's going to be far more gradual and it will stay up there higher. So the sugar addiction, as I mentioned, 4 months. Sexual addictions, it'll be at least 90 days, depending upon the sexual addiction. Caffeine, just 1 month. Caffeine, you can start having that great dopamine reset point in just 1 month, and it will also be well worth the effort. Reap the reward of an enhanced frontal lobe. Eliminate those frontal lobe hits, and when the frontal lobe is enhanced and no longer inhibited, these are just some of the benefits you will experience. Improved capacity to learn, retain, and apply knowledge. Yes, that means your IQ will go up. Increased ability to manage emotions, greater self-control, enhanced relationships, increased useful creativity, which can result in very positive financial consequences, greater empathy and compassion for others around you, and a heightened interest in useful learning. And you will be naturally developing a lot of positive character strengths as the frontal lobe becomes more enhanced, and that will add to your greater enjoyment of life.